Dominique, and yeah, I think this dialogue between prison sociology, which is really where I come from, I guess, and carceral geography is extremely productive. And I guess when I discovered that there was this set of people doing what looked to me like the kind of work that I and my colleagues were doing, it was kind of surprising and beautiful at the same time, that you suddenly realise that there are these parallel worlds of people using quite similar concepts and interested in quite similar issues, but not until Dominique really made it happen, not really talking to each other very much, not all that aware of each other's existence. So thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to start with this quotation from James Fernandez, an anthropologist who says, "Every anthropologist knows that the really fine ethnographies are sensitive to local figures of speech, the chief of which is metaphor. Metaphors lie at the base of inquiry and animate it." And in my experience, prisons are replete with metaphor. So when prisoners describe their experiences, when they talk about some of the frustrations of prison life, they very often turn to metaphorical language. So they're dangling carrots, so you're walking on eggshells. I think that is really meaningful within prison. Prisoners would know exactly what that means, even if that's indecipherable to outsiders. Or it's like being in a boat on the sea without oars. They keep turning the screw on you, and so on. And there's a great deal of literature on the presence of metaphor in everyday linguistic expression, but there's much less on the value of deploying metaphors as a strategy of inquiry. And so what I want to talk about today, I want to make a case for the adoption of conceptual metaphors as a means of comparing, and in the soft sense of the term, evaluating prison systems and regimes. So I'm going to start by explaining the development of a framework for such purposes that's organised around a set of basic metaphorical ideas. I'm then going to reflect on the value of this framework, and I'm going to try to say something about its spatial characteristics. So being invited to, kind of preparing for this paper has made me think a bit about the spatial dimensions of the metaphors that I'm using. And third, I want to outline how we've used this framework in recent empirical work, primarily a large comparative study of the experience of imprisonment in England and Wales compared to Norway. This is a very large study with Julie Lawson, Christian Mjaland, Anna Schlier, and Alice Irvins. And I guess the ambition to conceptualise prison life and to compare these two jurisdictions, England and Wales and Norway, derives partly from a concern with some of the limitations of what I would think of as macro-level accounts of penality and penal change. And I think in recent years there's been a kind of slew of research on things like comparative levels of punishment and on the relationship between political economy and penal severity, so the severity of punishment. But nearly all of these studies have, I guess, stopped at the gates of the prison, or they've only really entered the prison rather briefly and superficially. And I guess what I mean by that is that when they've tried to assess things like harshness or punitiveness, they've used metrics like imprisonment rates, or indicators, things like cell size or levels of overcrowding, or things that I would think of as inputs, like the length of staff training. And all of those things are really important, of course, but if you're a researcher like me who spends a lot of time sort of inside prisons looking out, rather than outside prisons squinting in, it feels really obvious that these measures are slightly deficient. So in particular, I think they tell us very little about the embodied and experiential dimensions of incarceration. So, for example, imprisonment rates, of course, reveal the sort of scale of confinement. That matters enormously, but they don't tell us anything about its nature. So it seems perfectly possible that a state might imprison relatively few people, but do so in conditions of brutality, or conversely, in prison widely but humanely. Secondly, I think it's a mistake to conflate the material with the psychological dimensions of incarceration. So, as my colleague Alison Liebling has demonstrated, what matters most to prisoners once their material conditions are above a certain threshold is how they are treated relationally, so how they're treated as moral agents, rather than just the physical environment in which they are held. Third, I think relying on things like policy statements or inputs assumes, I think, quite a naive relationship between, I guess, official discourse and what actually happens on the ground. So if your understanding of a penal system is based on government documents or even sort of penal policies, then you're assuming that these things are effectively and directly translated into practice, and that seems to me to be rather rare. And fourth, and I think most importantly for today's purposes, measures that have a single dimension just can't do justice to the complexity of the prison experience. So just to give a simple example, Nordic imprisonment is typically characterised as very mild and humane, so low imprisonment rates, small prisons, skilled staff, and so on. But the relatively high use in prisons in the Nordic countries of solitary confinement, mainly for prisoners on remand, points to the complexity even within these systems. So assessing a system of this kind and comparing it to others requires, I think, quite a sophisticated conceptual apparatus. Before trying to outline the apparatus that we've developed, I want to say something first that defends comparison and evaluation while also recognising their complexities. So I think both sort of radical and Foucauldian critiques tend to argue that the comparison of prison regimes obscures their sort of fundamental point about prisons, that they're essentially damaging and illegitimate. So Foucault's argument that modern forms of disciplinary power do not punish more humanely than the forms they replace, just more effectively, is instructive, because I think it does highlight something really important about the ineradicable character of power. But I also think that position has generated a slightly unhelpful form of nihilism, which forecloses the possibility of exploring which forms of penal power or which kinds of regimes or systems might be less damaging, less illegitimate than others. So to quote Ian Shapiro, Foucault's outlook lacks the tools to distinguish licit from illicit exercises of power. He does nothing to help us distinguish among more and less malevolent forms of domination. I think at the same time there are clearly some unresolved questions about how capable prisoners are as evaluators of their own predicament. So one sort of critique, one consideration, is that the conditions of confinement might produce what philosophers call adaptive preferences. So that is when people's views about their needs become adjusted to circumstances of deprivation, so that if we think that something is beyond our reach or is unrealistic, we tell ourselves that we don't really want it. Okay. Another concern is that stated preferences might be unreliable because they might be influenced by things like gendered discourses or misperceptions brought about by things like mental illness. So we know, for example, that prisoners often state a preference for an era when staff beat them up rather than, to quote, killed them off on file. But I think we should be very cautious about taking those sorts of statements at face value. They clearly tell us something about some of the sort of frustrations of new forms of power, and I'm going to come back to that. But I think we need to be careful about, sometimes be careful about taking statements about desires at face value. And so these considerations mean that comparison and evaluation are always tricky. But I would defend them because in my experience, most prisoners are very sophisticated normative evaluators of their own predicament. They are perfectly capable of identifying institutions that are more or less oppressive, degrading, invasive, and destructive than others. These distinctions matter to them, and I think therefore we need to take them seriously. And it's these kinds of terms that our framework is trying to capture. And we're using these ideas of the depth, weight, tightness, and breadth of imprisonment. So depth refers mainly to distance and difference from the outside world, with distance having a kind of literal dimension, so how far you are from the surface of freedom, as well as a more metaphorical meaning. So this encompasses sentence length, so that's the sort of temporal distance from freedom, but also things like isolation from normal social relations, both within the prison and beyond it, levels of security and control which determine the prisoner's physical autonomy and his or her sense of the remoteness of their existence. And it also refers to the extent of polarity between the prison and the community. So that includes the degree to which prisoners retain the normal rights of citizenship, and also how permeable the prison is in terms of forms of technology, external organisations, non-penal relationships, and so on. Weight is, I think the language of weight communicates the almost palpable sense of the sort of burden of imprisonment. So the sense that if staff are petty or provocative, or where conditions and facilities are poor, the experience of imprisonment can bear down upon you. So Roy King and Kathleen McDermott, who coined this phrase, talk about the sentence being a weight on one's shoulders. So this is partly about conditions, but it's mainly about interpersonal treatment. So aspects of what Liebling calls moral performance. So this is about things like respect, fairness, humanity, and so on, and the manner in which prison staff use their authority, which is itself is shaped by the moral status that they ascribe to prisoners, how they regard them as moral agents, moral beings. And these quotes from prisoners communicate these elements of weight, so the sense of authority being on your back, and its moral dimension. So in this last quote, you're just a piece of meat with a number on it. Tightness is, as a term, is meant to convey the sort of form and grip of new forms of penal power, which are psychological and informational, grounded in paperwork, bureaucratic decision-making, and abstract systems of assessment and observation. So they reflect first the sort of rationalisation of prison life, which generates frustrations relating to the difficulties of sort of navigating a disembodied penal bureaucracy. Second, forms of psychological assessments, cognitive behavioural interventions, and so on, which classify and label prisoners in ways that feel consequential, adhesive, and which misrecognise prisoners, or misrecognise who prisoners feel themselves to be, while subjectifying them into new modes of selfhood. And third, tightness is about policies like the incentives and earned privileges scheme, mandatory drug testing, early release schemes, and so on, all of which incite prisoners to self-monitor and regulate a wide range of conduct without the need for direct oversight. So again, I'm just trying to give you some examples of what I mean here. So to quote from this slide, this first prisoner says, "You're under observation from day one. I even think about who I walk around on exercise with, what I have on the walls of my cells, things like that." And in this second quote, the prisoner is describing the fact that, you know, I'm documented as a list of negative incidents. That's how I'm perceived. You're not listed as a person. So this form of power is sort of objectifying at the same time as it's subjectifying. So it addresses you as a person that's different from who you are, but you're required to sort of become a different kind of person in order to accelerate the sort of movement to release. And I've argued elsewhere that these forms of what I would call soft power are less coercive than traditional, harder means of control, but they're not always experienced as more humane, partly because in Foucauldian terms, they are disciplinary. So they address and invade the psyche and the self rather than just the body. Whoops. The fourth part of this framework is the idea of breadth, by which I mean the reach and impact of the sentence beyond the point of release, beyond the point of imprisonment. And I think clearly among the relevant factors here are the official disqualifications and disabilities that follow a conviction. But we're particularly interested in the forms of informal stigma and burdens and disadvantages that the prisoner experiences as a result of their sentence. Things like social prejudice, changes in health or demeanour or physicality, anxieties about being accepted back into community and society, reduced potential for intimacy and trust, the internalisation of certain rhythms of time and routine and so on. And it seems to me that documenting the role of prison systems in branding and diminishing prisoners and asking how enduring and how consequential these things are is a kind of crucial task for prison research and for comparative prison research. One of the strengths of this framework, I think, is that it enables comparison along a range of dimensions without implying that the evaluation of prison regimes or the judgment of regimes is straightforward or can be concluded through simple ideas about what's better and what is worse. So Victor Shamas here says, while viewing prison conditions through the optic of humane or inhumane conditions arguably produces a flattening one-dimensional gaze, the task of prison scholars might better be understood as studying how punitive power varies in kind rather than degree, and how the nature of pain imposition varies qualitatively. So on the one hand, I think the framework makes it possible to conceptualise a prison as, let's say, light rather than heavy, or shallow rather than deep. But these characterisations don't require a completely firm evaluative conclusion. So I think it's quite hard to say whether a prison that is run by prisoners rather than staff, and which allows family visits and quite a lot of internal mobility, so the kind of Latin American model, it is hard to say whether that's better or worse in any simple sense than a prison that is safer, run by staff, but more restrictive. And I think that's the case in part because with regard to moral quality, the dimensions are not unidirectional. So I think they work a bit like this. This is sort of depth and weight, and they're opposite shallowness and lightness. So a prison that is shallow is probably, by which we would normally mean an open prison, let's say, is probably preferable to one that's deep. But we know from work on open prisons, mainly in Norway, in fact, that the proximity to freedom and the feeling in an open prison that one misstep might jeopardise release creates an experience that is very bittersweet and can feel quite insecure, can feel slightly oppressive if you think that if you do one thing wrong, you end up back in closed conditions. And similarly, although intuitively we might think that a prison that's light is better than a prison that is heavy, empirically we know that most prisoners prefer an establishment that is somewhat heavy but is characterised by staff presence to one that is light but is characterised by the absence of power. So by absence I mean prisons in which staff lack authority or are permissive or fail to provide positive forms of authority, by which I mean mentoring and what we would call supportive limit setting, so protection from others and also protection from temptations. So these quotations capture this sense of power being absent. So this is a prisoner saying there's no structure, there's no rules, it's a free-for-all and staff barely exist. I'm involved in more criminal activity in here than I was on the out. That's not good, is it? And again, the language in this last quote is quite telling. If somebody asks you to do something here and you say, no, I'm not doing it, then they should be able to have the power and the weight behind them to actually enforce it. And Victor Shamas goes on to note that some pains are not easily given to cross-national comparison. I'd argue, and I agree with that to some degree, I think another strength of these metaphorical concepts is that they are sufficiently fuzzy and non-specific to straddle different cultures and jurisdictions. And so by reflecting on how they apply in different contexts, we can avoid what David Nelkin calls ethnocentrism, so the imposition of assumptions drawn from one culture onto another in comparative research. And that's partly because metaphors are essentially shortcuts from the specific to the abstract. So Michael Carithers notes that they widen our understanding by bringing in another domain of thought to a topic or speech. or to quote James Fernandez again, they move us from the inchoate to the concrete, to something that can be grasped beyond its local context. So just as illustration, that means that practices that seem specific to particular contexts, so in Norway, the expectation that prisoners feel, sort of, that prisoners are upbeat or genial, and in England and Wales, the demand of the incentives and earned privileges scheme that prisoners should demonstrate a proactive and self-motivated attitude, we can characterise both of these things that only really make sense within these particular jurisdictions as aspects of tightness. So, and the nature of this terminology itself, the fact that that we can understand these terms relatively intuitively, I like to think, enables us to classify the specific into the general relatively easily. And the fact that these metaphors correspond with linguistic expression is also important. So it's indicative of their experiential nature. That there are lots of other ways in which we might think about the effect of imprisonment. So we could think about them in terms of economic harm, physical harm, psychological harm, and so on. But I find those categories slightly too abstract, less capable of capturing the feel or the texture of penal power. Notably too, these concepts, depth, weight, tightness and breadth, are physical and spatial. And this is something that hadn't really occurred to me before I started thinking more about talking to geographers. So I think they all imply or express some sense of location or restriction, so some relationship between different domains of life. So depth is about restrictions on movement and distance from alternative life worlds. Weight is about the imposition of power, so the sort of downward force of moral judgment. Tightness is about the incursion of power into the psyche, and this sense of power enveloping and entangling the self. And breadth is about the drag and imprint of prison life on the individual beyond the boundary of the institution. And so collectively, I think these metaphors communicate the sense in which penal power presses on, shapes, and delimits the possibilities of body and being. And they remind us, therefore, that imprisonment is always, in some sense, about constraint, control, removal, and so on. And I think it's no coincidence that these metaphors invoke space. Lakoff and Johnson argue that the most basic metaphors, which are things like up, down, in, out, near, far, are spatial, arising out of everyday bodily experience. And in that respect, I think the fact that prisoners themselves use spatial and physical language is telling. It indicates the fundamental connection between imprisonment and mobility. So I've just given some examples here. You do feel a million miles away. There's more leeway. There's no weight to them. Officers are too young. Or with regard to tightness, this is a prisoner, I think, beautifully describing changes in prison life. So he says, the screws used to let you know, you step over that line and I'll have you. These days, they'll let you step over the line. They'll give you enough rope to hang yourself. You can just tie yourself up and then kill yourself with it. So this is really about responsabilization, forms of constrained autonomy. The framework is also open to refinement. So I want to move on to say something about the way that our thinking about these concepts has changed as we've used them as part of this comparative inquiry. I've spent most of the year in the close supervision system. So that is units in high security prisons for prisoners who have normally killed other prisoners, taken staff hostage. So people that are considered too difficult or dangerous to manage, even in high security prisons. So this is, I guess, the deepest part of the prison system in its simplest form. And one of the things that has been very interesting is that prisoners in these units have generally not described feeling isolated from outside relationships and events. And this is because they have relatively good access to things like phones, newspapers, television, and so on. And at the same time, so you get a sense of that from these quotations, but at the same time, because of their sentence lengths, the outside world often feels to them highly immaterial. So I ask, is it a concern for you that the world is changing? And my interviewee says, not really, it makes no difference to me, the outside world. I'm in jail, aren't I? I'm in a jail within a jail, so the outside world is kind of irrelevant to me. I'll be in my 60s before I have any real chance of getting out. And so the idea that depth expresses the distress caused by being distant from the world outside, it is slightly deficient. It doesn't quite work because the qualities of the outside world are irrelevant to many of these prisoners. So we get a sense of that from this quote. The first is from a prisoner who was serving a whole life tariff, so that means there's no possibility of release. And he says, nothing exists for me outside these walls. The only thing that applies to me is custody. And the second quote is from a man who said that before his sentence, he had been homeless, he had no stable or intimate relationships. So he says, I never felt part of the free world. I'm as close to the world outside as I was when I was there. So at the extreme point of the system, some of these metaphors don't quite function in the way that we thought they might. But also these distinctions affect, I guess, the sort of sub-metaphors that are most apt for describing confinement in this part of the system. The prisoners who most often used the language of being buried were those who felt that there were simply no exit routes out of these units, as we see here. And burial conveys this idea of the impossibility of lateral movement. It conveys a sense of hopelessness, abandonment, and suffocation. But for other prisoners, a more pertinent way of thinking about their predicament was the idea of being submerged rather than being buried. And this way of thinking about depth allows a distinction to be made between distance from the surface, so sort of access to aspects of the world outside, and distance from land, so from freedom or from the resumption of life. So it's possible for prisoners to feel relatively close to the surface, but a very, very long way from solid land, as it were. What complicates all of this a bit more is the fact that some prisoners described the fact that they welcomed the restrictiveness of their conditions. And they would talk about these very, very secure, restrictive units using terms that were closer to sort of liberation than suffocation. Some of this was about the relief of being insulated from the obligations of prison politics and being able to mix with staff openly without other prisoners calling you a grass. Others described the sense of psychological freedom that came with knowing that there was, to quote, nothing more the system can do to me. Some disputed that the outside world was any less restrictive than their environment. So when I asked one prisoner how far he felt from the outside, from the free world, he queried the premise of my question. He said it's not a free world out there, and said he felt freer than he thought prison staff were in his mind. And another offered a similar logic, saying he was no less free than I was, it's just that the bars are a bit closer for him than they are for me. And so perceptions of depth seem to be far more subjective and far more variant than perceptions of weight. This is really interesting. I think, so the experience of what we might think of as moral treatment, so humanity, fairness, and so on, generates much more consensus than considerations of depth. That I'm wondering if this tells us something about how sort of elemental those things are. We know respect and disrespect when we feel them. I should also add that depth is not always closely linked with the prison's security category. So, as I've said, prisoners in these very, very, in these units that by any sort of objective measure are highly, highly restrictive, but prisoners there described that they actually had more, although they were very constrained in lots of ways, they never left these units unless they had to go to hospital, but they were out of their cells a lot. Whereas in one of the other prisons that we've been going to recently, which is a medium security training prison, prisoners are locked up so much that they describe their experience much more in a conventional terminology of depth than these prisoners in the close supervision system did. With regard to tightness, three main points have become clear, three ways in which we're beginning to think differently about this idea. The first is that it operates laterally as well as vertically. And by that I mean that discipline occurs not just through the institution trying to cultivate a particular kind of non-offending persona, but also through prisoners assessing and censoring each other's behaviours and dispositions. So we're finding this in particular in the prisons that we're going to that hold sex offenders. So, and there, sex offenders are engaging in forms of what Susie Scott calls performative regulation. And she defines that as when people submit themselves to the authority of an institution, internalise its values, and enact them through mutual surveillance in an inmate culture. Interestingly, Susie Scott's book, which is wonderful, it's a kind of critique of Goffman's idea of the total institution. So she argues that there's a variety of what she calls reinventive institutions that have certain characteristics in common with total institutions, but are entered into voluntarily, that involve horizontal rather than vertical discipline, and so on. But she's not talking about the prison. Okay, so it's interesting that you can fit the prison into this framework. So she says, power operates horizontally as well as vertically, as members monitor each other's conduct, sanction deviance, and evaluate their own progress in relative terms. Any of you that have been to therapeutic communities within prison, I think this description will make sense there as well. So what we see in these quotations are comments from prisoners that I think represent this form of performative regulation. So prisoners sort of judging their peers along lines that correspond with institutional goals and language. So this first prisoner says, you know, I turn around and say, you need to go on the course and pronto. You need to sort your life out. You need to sort your thoughts out, your patterns. And that idea of thoughts and patterns, that's institutional language. But this is a prisoner sort of using this language as a way of monitoring and regulating his peers, and also evaluating his own, sort of practicing his own persona. Second, prisons can be loose as well as tight. So they're loose when they continue to demand certain kinds of behaviours from prisoners, but are themselves deficient in enabling or recognising change. So we see this when prisoners complain that they're unable to access the offending behaviour programmes that they are required to complete in order to progress through the system. Or when they say, I've got a parole board hearing coming up and my paperwork hasn't been done. So that is a complaint that the prison is not gripping tightly enough. It's about the lack of grip rather than the tightness of its hold. And third, and this is a connected point, tightness can be welcomed. So when I originally thought about the idea of tightness, I thought of it as a purely negative thing. Some prisoners are purely strategic in the way that they engage with these new forms of penal power, and so they might solicit a psychological diagnosis, or they might appreciate some degree of institutional attention to ensure that in relation to progressing through the system, they're not neglected, right? So if the prison doesn't spot you, it doesn't have anything to work on, it's less likely that it spots change and pushes you through the system. So that's that logic. But also there are prisoners who feel shame about their offending or believe that there is something wrong with them that the prison ought to remedy. And so for them, the kind of close harness of penal power is not experienced as something oppressive. So all of this means that tightness is much more complex than we initially thought. And I'm trying to think about this in relation to clothing. So when we talk about a piece of clothing being tight, that might mean it's very constraining, but it might mean that it fits beautifully. And likewise, clothing that is loose might be baggy in a way that's comfortable or in a way that is disagreeable. And that depends on whether the absence of grip is indicative of a prison in which you actually have quite a lot of autonomy. You're not being evaluated, assessed, and monitored all the time. So that's an institution that is less demanding and invasive. Or looseness might be something that jeopardises your release. So I worked this up today. This is beginning to make sense to me, but if you have better terminology here, so that the vertical axis is tight, loose. I can't quite work out the horizontal axis, but to the right is kind of the positive version of what these things might mean. and on the left the negative version. The most fun part of my talk is this. So I guess the main point I'm making is that both tightness and looseness might be positive or negative. But this is the most, is the best way I've, this is, hold on. Let me just pause it. This is the most effective way in my head of thinking about what tightness might be. Let me just sort out the volume. So, I'm guessing most of you are familiar with it. This is the film Toy Story.
Fingerbest on the sector 12. Who's in charge here?
Bob's
our master.
Bob
chooses who will go and who will stay.
This is ludicrous.
They
both
love you. Get
out of here.
Oh, no. Sit. Get down.
What's that
to
you, Sheriff?
You are the one that decided 5 minutes.
Bob, it moves. I have been chosen. There will, my friends. I'm going to a better place.
So, the line I like in particular is, the claw is our master. The claw chooses who will go and who will stay. So, to be liberated from the machine, the items in the pit require the claw. They need to fit into its pincers. But whether you as an individual are gripped or not feels very arbitrary. And even if you are, it's always possible that you'll slip from its grasp. I don't know if that makes sense. That makes perfect sense in my head. With regard to breadth, our investigation into entry into custody in Norway has highlighted the way that the impact of the prison can relate to the period that precedes the sentence as well as the time that follows it. So for some prisoners who are in the prison queue, so this is when you've been sentenced but you're waiting to be informed about when you need to present yourself at a prison to begin your sentence. This state of waiting is extremely burdensome, as these field notes convey. These are notes from my colleague Christian Bjarland. So he's talking about a prisoner who said he was in the queue for approximately 5 months, and he describes the waiting as hell. He was isolated, he almost didn't leave his home. He woke up every morning and thought about it. He hated the time of day when the postman came, in other words, with the letter that would tell him when he had to go to the prison. He felt like throwing up several times. He considered leaving the city and disappearing. He was afraid and shameful. When the letter finally came, he said he was relieved. A friend contacted the prison on his behalf. She drove him to the prison, and in the car he kept thinking, finally I am on my way. This is really fascinating language, because that final statement, finally I'm on my way, that's the kind of phrase we might associate with release from prison rather than reception into it. So it just captures this sense of the oppressiveness of anticipating the sentence. Meanwhile, we've found that for sex offenders in particular, the anticipation of release is often experienced as more stressful than imprisonment itself. And this is fueled both by fears about victimization when you're back in the community, but also rumors that are often inaccurate, but that circulate among sex offenders about the scale and the terms of their license conditions. So as expressed here, life on release is described in terms that are redolent of Agamben's idea of bare life. So this sort of being completely deprived of agency and of the normal rights of citizenship. And so these fears and anxieties about the future alter the subjective experience of the present. And they also help to illuminate the relationship between breadth and depth. So when we ask sex offenders questions that are designed to tap into issues of depth, they often use metaphors that are horizontal rather than vertical. So they talk about being lost, being in a maze, being kept in a box. One prisoner said it's like waiting at a train station and the train keeps going past and you can't get on it. So these descriptions suggest removal from the outside world, but not really submersion beneath it. And I think this is really instructive. This is telling us about the way that their lives have changed. So for these prisoners, the nature of their offence often meant that their life had changed permanently. So there was no surface to return to. So changes with regard to personal relationships, social status and so on meant that they couldn't really compare the domain of imprisonment with an outside world that was so unstable and so hard for them to imagine. So this means that breadth has a kind of two-way temporal dimension. So life after release is shaped by the lingering effect of the sentence, but the feel of the sentence is shaped by expectations of life on release. And meanwhile, our research into the prison queue means we're thinking about the way that breadth extends before the sentence as well as after it. So imprisonment casts a shadow in all directions. Depth is also related to tightness. So this is a prisoner who was very litigious within the close supervision system, so these very secure units. So he says, my psychologist said, you're caught in a vicious cycle, and she's correct. They do things to me, I challenge it, they don't like the fact that I'm successful predominantly with the challenge, so they go and write something about me that buries me deeper. In other words, writing something in your file, which I've always thought of in relation to tightness, is what keeps you in this part of the system. So the terminology is significant, as it is in this second quotation. Psychologists are trying to get more ammunition to bury me deeper in the system. So tightness and depth become mutually reinforcing. So I hope that my case for this framework has been reasonably persuasive. I guess in the research that we're doing at the moment, it's providing us with the sort of basis for and contours of description and analysis. So it's a kind of cross-cultural discourse that allows us to compare jurisdictions that are so different in their practices, size of the prisons, the ways they accommodate different kinds of prisoner groups, as to sometimes seem incomparable. And it does so in a way that moves us away from the specificity of the local without, I think, sacrificing a focus on the experiential. I want to be able to capture the experience of imprisonment, but in a way that allows comparison across domains. So this conceptual shorthand, we think, is helping us get closer not just to comparing different penal systems, but the experiences of different prisoner groups. Mainstream male prisoners, sex offenders, female prisoners, but also different points in the prison systems, entry into custody, pre-release, high security, and so on. And in doing so, as I've tried to illustrate, we're also beginning to understand the relationship between different aspects of the prisoner experience. So metaphor is serving not just as a means of description, but also as the building block for theorising imprisonment more broadly. Thank you.